To today's official session moderator, Cindy Frickle.
Hello, thanks for joining us today on our Combined Remedies webinar. I just want to announce the topic today is Combining Remedies, Adaptive, Flexible, Attentive Use of the Right Tools. This webinar, this topic is becoming increasingly prevalent across the spectrum of hazardous waste sites from relatively simple to more complex. This trend is driven by, one, a larger remedial toolbox, and two, by increased understanding that contamination occurs in different phases and concentrations and in different subsurface compartments. But combining remedies is only part of the story. Flexible, attentive, adaptive deployment is equally important, as surprises are not uncommon and conditions change during remedy implementation. This webinar will discuss the underlying principles of attentive deployment of a variety of remedial technologies, along with informative case studies, with particular emphasis on NPL sites. Our presenter today is Jim Cummings. Jim is in the Technology Assessment Branch in the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Site Remediation and Technology Innovation here at EPA headquarters. He has over 25 years of experience in the development, evaluation, and deployment of innovative tools for characterization and remediation of hazardous waste sites. He provides technical support to federal and state RPMs in cleanup of wood treaters, former manufactured gas plants, and chlorinated solvent sites. Jim has chaired sessions and presented at dozens of domestic and international remediation conferences. That may be an underestimate. And his recent interests include the use of combined remedies to exploit synergies among technologies and accelerate site closure. With that, I'm going to hand it over to Jim, and you'll get started.
Good afternoon. Thanks, Cindy. And I appreciate everybody joining us. Those of you that have attended my early work in this area, I was a big hammer guy, mostly focused on the in-situ thermal remedies because they were pretty powerful. But about 10 years ago, I suppose, it became apparent that while addressing the sources was absolutely crucial, addressing the sources is necessary but not necessarily sufficient. So I became interested in other tools, follow-on tools that could help us, in fact, get to site closure and hopefully deletion of sites from the national priorities list. So the focus of our discussion today is going to be on combined remedies. I've also had the opportunity to conduct workshops around the country with the National Groundwater Association and more recently with the New England Waste Management Officials Association, and I enjoyed working with them and the opportunity to get the word out on this area. Interestingly enough, though, even though we used the title combined remedies in our earlier workshops with NGWA and NUMOA, we all understood that it was more than just lashing tools together, and we're going to talk about the idea of being attentive through the course of your remedial technology deployment. Next slide, please. Again, the bottom line here is combining remedies, yes, you can, and yes, you probably should, although I'm not suggesting that there aren't sites where a single remedy may be sufficient. A gentleman gave a nice presentation at an AEHS conference a few years ago about a relatively small home heating oil project. And he used three or four different technologies, and it was a very thoughtful and useful presentation. And also, interestingly enough, as I've spoken at the Battelle conferences for the last 10 or 15 years, I notice every 2 years it seems like there's a 20% increase in the increment of presentations which show some awareness of using more than one tool. Next slide, please. Also, as I say, by way of preliminaries, and again, I've been doing this for 20, 25 years, it's also true that we've got a much larger toolbox, and that's one of the reasons we can even talk about combining remedies. Back in the day when we were in DNAPL denial and everybody was pretty much just doing pump and treat, there really wasn't much to talk about in terms of combining remedies. But now with the advent of many more tools, some of which we'll talk about a bit today, especially in situ, we've got more choices that we can make. And also, as I'll discuss through the course of my remarks, it's much better process control than we once had. And so that's one of the key aspects of getting these projects through to successful completion. Also, besides the larger toolbox, our scientific understanding of the subsurface and the different compartment and phases of contamination We're starting to understand better the fact that heterogeneity isn't an exception, it's the norm, and that the importance of investing in better conceptual site models. Joe Quinnan from Arcadis coined the term return on investigation to try to convince people that it was not wasted money, but rather money well spent. And also it's important, and we'll discuss today, the subsurface, is, besides being heterogeneous, is absolutely not static before or during the remediation. And to think otherwise is to run the risk of having things not go as you would wish or expect. Next slide. So besides talking about the tools and combining them, we're going to talk repeatedly about the necessity of being flexible, being able to respond as conditions change, and paying attention. And we're getting much better at the availability not only of characterization tools and remediation tools, but sensors that can be installed and used throughout the course of the remediation to help control the processes that you're trying to employ. Next slide. Again, high resolution. I prefer to call it higher resolution. We're certainly doing better than we once were able to do, but one of our concerns is that we're still making too many simplifying assumptions about the nature and extent of contamination. So, for example, assuming or continuing to conclude that things are homogeneous and isotropic does mainly bad things to us. So when we get to the point of being able to have the resolution compatible with the kind of assumptions we make, I think we'll be in a better position. Next slide. I thought I'd start with this observation with regard to bioaugmentation, which again, I think it's fair to say that just about every combination of technologies that people are using today, at the end of the day, will either include bio in some biostimulated or bioaugmented form or with or monitored or natural attenuation. But in the mid-90s, generally speaking, bioaugmentation was not a favored remedy. The fear was that the established microorganisms were so powerful that they would basically eat the new guys for lunch. Fast forward 10 years, and now it seems to be the case that people are bioaugmenting sometimes without even looking to see whether the Dehalococcoides microorganisms that can fully dechlorinate are even present. Recent workshop here in Reston, one of the vendors of bioaugmentation products indicated to me that probably 30% of the time now they're selling their products to people that aren't even looking to see whether the existing microorganisms were present. They're just going ahead and bioaugmenting. Next slide. Also, a momentary aside, we recently became sensitized to the fact that there seemed to be an over-reliance, if you will, on chemistry and an under-reliance on geology. So we're trying to get the word out that paying attention to geology, both in terms of its principles and in terms of ensuring that adequate members of your team have the adequate levels of knowledge and experience with regard to geology and hydrogeology. Next slide. And again, rather than using Krieging, our preference to the extent that we can, we should be getting better at using geology to help connect the dots. After all, it's the plumbing. It's telling us where the contamination is and where it's going, which, of course, are the two main things that we're interested in. Next slide. And then again, I'm not a geologist, but those that are, one of the examples they've cited to me are this particular example of suspended load channels as a way to understand the nature of the subsurface and the way it stores and distributes contamination. Next slide. Also, EPA recently put out an environmental sequence stratigraphy paper, and here's a reference if you're interested in looking into it. Next slide. And again, I say it's becoming increasingly prevalent at conferences and in my interactions with my RPMs. So again, at one time it was novel. I would argue that at the moment they're present, and hopefully for the future it's now the norm as opposed to an exception. Next slide. Again, we've got more tools, bigger toolbox. We now understand that there's free product, there's sorbed phase, there's dissolved phase. There's a vapor intrusion phase, and also, as I said earlier, combining remedies is not necessarily just for the larger and more complex sites. Next slide. Also, it's important to, back please, a little quick on the trigger there. At one point, I suppose, for 10 years or so, especially if people were talking about matrix diffusion or back diffusion, there was the idea that it was a dual domain model, basically a transmissive and a storage situation. I think some more recent work has suggested that the results that we're seeing or the situations that we're seeing in the field suggest that, in fact, well, actually, it's probably a continuum, but it certainly it's better to think of a three-domain model as opposed to a simple two-domain model. So 90% of the mass is in the transmissive zones. Maybe 9% is in the zones where advection is occurring but is occurring more slowly, and then maybe 1% is actually happening in the storage zones. Similarly, back diffusion is often adduced as a reason why remediation is going to be difficult, if not impossible. I think in many cases it's an engineering issue, not necessarily a fatal limitation. There was a DOD workshop a few years ago in which a DOD person said, well, we know we've got matrix diffusion, but we're not seeing rebound. And we're not going to dwell on it today, but it does appear that the matrix is not necessarily defenseless. Even the low permeability zones may have biotic and abiotic mechanisms that are at work that could either prevent rebound entirely or it might bleed out at a rate that is compatible with the assimilative capacity. So anyway, next slide. Going to go through some examples here. As I say, they're not exhaustive, limited only by your imagination. And again, it's not like you need a supercomputer to figure out all of the combinations and their permutations. I think it's fair to say that they kind of sort themselves out relatively naturally, and that you shouldn't have to worry about more than three or four different combinations as you progress with your evaluation. Interestingly enough, as I say, when I started out doing a lot of thermal work, thermal now, there are hundreds of applications. If you had told me in the late 90s that that was going to be the case, I would have been shocked. But I'm pleased to report that it's increasingly used both domestically and internationally. But again, the thermal remedies, resistive heating and conductive heating, for example, are particularly suitable in lower permeability strata, whereas the steam-enhanced extraction has advantages where there's sufficient permeability that you can get steam distribution. So we've got a number of projects that have been conducted where they've combined different thermal remedies. There's also some growing interest in not necessarily heating all the way to the temperature that you need to address a particular contaminant, say at 100 degrees centigrade or so, but rather heating up to a lower temperature, and we'll get to that in a bit, where you can maximize the biological processes and the fact that hydrolysis rates go up dramatically with every 10 degrees or so of increase in the temperature of the subsurface. Next slide. And again, you can combine thermal and bio. Next, keep just progress through those, Cindy. If necessary, if you're worried about the fact that there's going to be a fair amount of mass left even after the thermal, and you're worried about the stoichiometric demand of an in-situ chemical oxidation remedy, you can use the ISCO to break it up into smaller particles and then turn it over to the bio. A couple of our case studies today will discuss the use of different oxidants. They have different properties in terms of their strength and their persistence and their the contaminants that they can address. Next slide. Again, obviously, ISCO and bio, we're going to talk about the fact that many of the chemical oxidation vendors are, in fact, becoming a combination of ISCO and bio. Next slide. And then again, interestingly enough, the idea of combining in-situ chemical oxidation with in-situ chemical reduction. The ITRC put out a document a few years ago in which they said, well, if you're going to do ISCO, you probably don't want to do in-situ chemical reduction because the two of them will just neutralize each other. Well, you model the distribution of your oxidant and then just put your reactive barrier far enough down gradient to handle whatever's next, and that's actually happened at a few sites. Some people have argued that oxidation is an aqueous phase reaction, so maybe we should add a surfactant to increase the aqueous loadings, thereby enabling the two technologies to be complementary, and there's a number of case studies on that. In-situ stabilization solidification combined with the other remedies has also been used at half a dozen sites. Next slide. And again, I didn't mean to rule out ex-situ. Where necessary or suitable, digging stuff up before you then polish it off with an in-situ remedy makes tremendous sense. Next slide. I also wanted to spend a minute. It turns out that as early as 1992, Some folks were suggesting that you could biodegrade pentachlorophenol, for example, by first using a chemical oxidant to break the molecule up into a smaller molecule that the bugs could more easily process. Similarly, the Institute of Gas Technology, about 5 years later, came up with a patent, actually, to do a sequential biological, chemical, biological treatment. And then Mark Zappi, who was once at the Corps of Engineers, is now dean at the University of Louisiana, also came up with the idea of using a chemical oxidant to prime the subsurface to enable subsequent processing through biological mechanisms. Next slide. The approaches to this, and this is kind of at a high level, and this will be fairly obvious to most folks. And by the way, this presentation, as you've seen already by the number of acronyms we used, is intended for folks who have at least a passing familiarity with site characterization and remediation, rather than being for introductory level people. But the point is that the main approaches to combining remedies, obviously the temporal approach, is you use one remedy until you reach some point of diminishing returns, and then you change it over to another technology. Next slide. And then the one that's probably been the most used and the most well understood is treating different zones. So again, there was a time when people were not aware that DNAPL was as prevalent and serious a problem as it was. But now we understand that you need to treat the different zones with different technologies. So you need a big hammer or a medium hammer to address the sources. Stronger the source, the bigger the hammer. And then you can use other polishing steps, down gradient as it were, to address the contamination, because unfortunately we've allowed many of our sites to stew for 20 or 30 years. And to some extent, the horses have left the barn, so you got to chase those down as well. When I first started doing it, we kind of talked about those two approaches. Need to go back. And then more recently, based on some of the presenters that we've used in our workshops with NGWA and NMOA, we became sensitized to the fact, and there's vendors that we'll talk about in a minute, where they're what we call package deals. That is to say, instead of having to lash different technologies together, some of the tools actually have more than one mechanism of action. And so it's useful to understand and appreciate that, because the monitoring and the progression of your remedy will occur using these several mechanisms of action. Next slide. So package deals. Turns out, next slide, that, as I said a few minutes ago, it looks like, and I'll have some examples for you in just a minute, many, if not most, of the institutional chemical oxidation vendors are, in fact, combining their technologies with a biocomponent, especially those that are susceptible to aerobic biodegradation. And I think I've got a few examples of that here. We're not going to spend that much time on them. And as we said on the disclaimer, any mentions of vendors or projects are intended for illustrative purposes only. We're not endorsing any particular vendor. Next slide. Regenesis and their product manual for the Regenox product indicated that they thought it was Chemox is best coupled with accelerated bio. Again, your oxidant works, leaves behind oxygen, which can then be employed by the microorganisms to conduct their degradation processes. Next slide. I think I was three or four examples here. FMC, which is now Peroxychem, almost 10 years ago now, I guess time flies, they launched their Closure CR product, and CR actually stands for combined remedy, that it intends to couple oxidation with enhanced bio. Next slide. The SRS folks combine their emulsified zero-valent iron in a way that's intended to combine both biotic and abiotic reductive dechlorination. Technology that was actually developed by NASA, and they've got a license for that, and they've used it for DAPL, Freon, and biobarrier applications. I think I've got one more example. Next slide. The Redox Tech folks have their ABC Plus, and it's also another product offered by Peroxychem, their EHC product, which again, the whole idea there is to promote both reductive dechlorination and anaerobic biodegradation. Those of you that are familiar with biological processes, you can't have stalling of the biodegradation at DCE or vinyl chloride, and it's thought that as a general matter, the beta elimination pathways that are offered by the reductive dechlorination abiotically avoid those particular problematic daughter products. Next slide. 5 years to 10 years ago, the Navy did a report on a number of their electrical resistance heating projects, and they published a report. And even though you think of thermal as being a big hammer, it turns out, next slide, that one of the major conclusions of that report, that of the five projects that they looked at, besides the volatilization and steam stripping, which are the main mechanisms that you get when you use ERH, is that both enhanced bio and abiotic reactions were occurring. Also, as I mentioned in my introductory remarks, a number of sites where the contaminants seem to be susceptible of hydrolysis, it may be suitable or acceptable to heat bulb modestly in the subsurface and then allow the hydrolysis processes to do the bulk of the heavy lifting. Next slide. Monitored natural attenuation, and again, that's the kind of a holy grail. And the Technology Innovation Office, I've been around long before there was M&A, when it first came along, we were concerned that nobody would underspend a nickel on technology development because M&A was going to take care of all of the polishing problems. But turns out that it's not necessarily the case, and as I mentioned earlier, this possible problem both for active ISCO and for M&A is the potential for stall at a level that is, or contaminants that are problematic. By way of a note, EPA's M&A guidance specifically provides that we think it's most suitable when you do something about the source first. Also might note that, again, those of you that are familiar with the, both bio and M&A processes, back in the old days, we would look for things like decreasing concentration or shrinking or stable plumes. We now have an increasing array of quantitative tools and lines of evidence that give us more confidence that the biodegradation or destructive processes are actually happening. And those are mentioned there in the last bullet. I won't bother to. qPCR, qualitative polymerase chain reactions, PLFA, phospholipid fatty acids, et cetera. But again, anybody who's not aware of those quantitative tools, the Microbial Insights folks in particular have a wealth of information on their websites about those tools. Next slide. Also, it turns out that M&A itself may be a natural combination. There are both biotic and abiotic mechanisms that, again, we started off with M&A mostly focused on the biological. But more recently, the availability of abiotic mechanisms. John Wilson, who's recently retired from our laboratory, has been investigating magnetic susceptibility. There are a host of people who think there's other metallic species that may also be useful in that regard. And there's also a fair amount of research, much of it funded by the Department of Defense, looking into biogeochemical transformation. There's also a term called biologically mediated abiotic degradation, in which it's thought that the microorganisms are basically not doing the heavy lifting themselves, but rather are potentiating the metallic species, which then do the actual contaminant destruction. Next slide. And again, when we got interested in combining remedies, there was a hope that the whole would be greater than the sum of the parts. There's a number of reasons to be hopeful in that regard. Next slide. The first of which is, and I've got a slide on that in a moment, that both thermal and ISCO technologies applied in the source zone release significant dissolved phase carbon. And that carbon, it turns out, in many if not most cases, is actually bioavailable. Next slide. Here's an example from a early resistive heating project. The blue information in the foreground are the levels of dissolved phase carbon before the electrical resistance heating was conducted, and the purple in the background is a reflection of what the dissolved phase carbon looked like afterwards, and as indicated on the slide, it was 41 times higher. So the point is, if your budget and scheduling and resources allow, why not schedule the follow-on polishing step in the dissolved phase to take advantage of that dissolved phase carbon. And next slide. And besides the dissolved phase carbon, there's a tremendous amount of work that's pretty conclusively demonstrated that the dechlorinating microorganisms that are operative really like 30 to 35 degrees centigrade. Next slide. So, to the extent that you have the wherewithal to do so, it would certainly seem to be worth considering to implement your biological follow-on process while the free carbon is moving through your system and the water is migrating at a temperature that is desirable. Next slide. This is a little bit of more in the area of policy and administrative procedure, but type one, I use that term mainly to indicate that that's the preferred approach, and that is, as opposed to trying to do it after the fact in an ad hoc way, try to be anticipatory and intentional in your consideration of combining remedies. And one of the technologies or case studies we're going to talk about in a bit, including it in the original decision documents. But again, you can also write your ROD if you're doing NPL type work by explicitly providing for mid-course corrections, depending on what the site is telling you as the remedy progresses. Next slide. And again, so you don't get around to that, or you're working on a site that's 20 years old and somebody has decided that pump and treat is no longer cost effective, but that you still can't close out the site. There's nothing wrong with stopping the presses, as it were, and reconsidering what you might do to bring the thing to fruition. Next slide. And again, doing it in phases, in a progressive or even contingent way. And as I say, I'm going to spend a fair amount of time talking about a resistive heating and bio project and a dry cleaner that we did in Grants, New Mexico. And the ROD itself was even written in terms of this then. And I'll be talking about that a bit more. Next slide. And actually, the ROD specified that we were going to do resistive heating in the source zone. Actually, there were two of them, an active and a closed dry cleaner. But then what we said was, in the ROD itself, we were going to do either ISCO or reductive dechlorination as the next phase, both spatially and temporally, depending on how a pilot came out. And it turned out that they did the pilot, and the reductive dechlorination was suitable. And generally speaking, it's less expensive. So that's what they went with. Next slide. Also, as I said in my remarks, even though we use the title Combined Remedies, how you go about it is at least as important, maybe more important than exactly which tools you use. And even though we do have higher resolution than we once had, it is still difficult to punch enough holes to really understand the true nature and extent of contamination in the subsurface. So again, remedy implementation is the next phase of site characterization. Similarly, and especially for ISCO remedies, when you start off on the site, oftentimes there's so much dust and smoke that you can't really tell where the strong sources are and or where the zones are that are going to respond most effectively to your initial remedial intervention. So if you look at an ISCO case study, as often as not, after phase one or the first round of injections, the remaining bullseyes will start to become more prominent. And as a general matter, if you're paying attention, the subsequent rounds of injection, and most ISCO remedies do require multiple rounds, the subsequent rounds should be smaller. So again, as we've said before, and we'll probably say again before this is over, flexible, adaptive, and attentive is the right, in fact, it's the only posture that people should be using today. Next slide. It turns out, by the way, that not only is remedy implementation an important part of site characterization, even installing the system can be informative if you're paying attention. The AECOM folks two or three years ago put on a very nice webinar of an ERH job on the East Coast, and they were installing the electrodes into the top of the confining unit, and it turned out that the topology of that confining unit was significantly different than they had thought, and as a result, the groundwater flow regime. So if they hadn't been paying attention, if they hadn't adjusted their groundwater monitoring infrastructure accordingly, it would have all been wasted because they would have been monitoring and looking for the plume in the wrong direction. Next slide. And again, as I said in my introductory remarks, process control is important, and we're getting better at doing that. One of the reasons I was interested in thermal in the first place is we did a better job of that. If you monitored the temperature and got it to where you wanted it as a function of the attributes of the contaminant and kept it there long enough, you could be pretty sure that you'd get the results that you wanted. The ISCO folks have certainly come a long way in that regard, and for the most part, they're monitoring dissolved oxygen, oxygen reduction potential, conductivity. If it's permanganate, you can monitor the color on a fairly frequent basis, and so that's certainly, I would consider, one of the main advantages or progressions that we've done in terms of our remedial practice. Next slide. And by the way, if anybody's got burning questions, we're going to go through the front part of this, and then we'll stop before the case studies to take any questions that might have developed. And again, I'm not a microbiologist, but it certainly seems to me that bio, of all of the remedies, is probably the most, not fragile, but the most dynamic, and that as subsurface redox conditions change, as groundwater flow regimes change, as seasonal infiltration rates or geometries of the plume change, as nutrient fluxes change, just a host of variables, it certainly seems to me that of all the remedies, bio is one that should be monitored. Not again, not necessarily every day or every hour, but certainly as a function of some indication of how dynamic the subsurface is. And I got this quotation from Jack Sheldon of the Antia Group, who was one of my speakers when we did the collaboration with the National Groundwater Association folks. If anybody has any attitudes or impressions about that subject, by the way, I'd be delighted to hear from you afterwards, whether you think we need to do more of it or whether there may be situations that are sufficiently static that kind of monitoring is not necessary. But I'd like to be able to perhaps have someone write a paper on, okay, which conditions are most important for careful monitoring and which are more suitable for less timely evaluation of the processes. Next slide. And here's a paper that I think is fairly seminal. In fact, John Wilson, many of you may know, actually used this paper in one of the figures in one of his presentations at the REMTEC conference. And again, although they call for a lot more research, which I guess what you'd expect to have happen in a paper like this, it certainly points out the many reasons why and how biological processes are more dynamic than perhaps is as well understood as it should be. Next slide. Okay, I said we'd pause for a moment before we get into a few case studies to see if anybody had any questions. Cindy, anybody on the line?
If anyone has any questions right now that they'd like to ask Jim or comments or anything you'd like him to expand further upon from the start of this talk, please type that into the Q&A box, and you should be in the lower right-hand corner of your screen. Jim, I do have one question for you. Can you discuss the costs of combined remedies a little bit? Are they additive if you do more than one remedy, or how does that compare to singular remedies?
Well, especially in the early days of combining remedies, particularly the folks that have to write the checks to pay the bills on those projects, that was what they were concerned about. They were concerned that combining remedies was going to be additive, that you were going to have to be bringing in multiple vendors with different staffing and overhead rates. Ideally, of course, we're using the right tool in the right location. So at least in principle, the cost should be a wash, or more hopefully, especially if you can exploit some of the synergies that we've talked about, you might actually save some money. So I think it's turned out to be the case that it's certainly been cost effective to pursue these sorts of approaches. And furthermore, it's also the case that because you're paying better attention and you're understanding the situation better, you have a higher level of confidence that the remedial action objectives that have been established will actually be able to be achieved.
Thank you. And I do have another question from a listener. Can you talk more about the rod example that was on, I believe it's the Grants New Mexico dry cleaner rod?
Yes, in fact, that's going to be one of the case studies that we'll talk about in a minute. And there's plenty of information available on that particular site, and hopefully through this presentation you'll see enough information that will enable you to go to the web and find out. In fact, I think the entire record of decision is actually on the Internet.
Okay, we'll come back to that one if you don't answer the question completely in the case study. And I have another question. How do these concepts of combined remedies apply to remediation of radionuclides?
Well, I should have said as an introductory remark that the focus of today's presentation was on chlorinated solvents, and I apologize for not having made that clear, so I hope that this wasn't a burning question. I don't know enough about radionuclides to be able to give you a sophisticated answer to that. It's just very problematic. I do know that, because again, as Cindy said in her introductory remarks, I do a lot of work on wood treaters and former manufactured gas plant sites. And those are certainly suitable for the use of combined remedies. In fact, I didn't present one today, but there was and I apologize for this digression. I'm not answering the question, but I did want to note the one of the MGP sites in Augusta, Georgia. They did in-situ stabilization solidification for the areas that they could get to, but because there was a lot of free product under a historic African-American church, they did in-situ chemical oxidation under the church. Again, I apologize. I don't have any insights or experience with RAD, but maybe it's something that we can look into and see if the folks in our office who've done RAD work have any experience in that area.
Okay, thank you, Jim. I think we'll continue now, and as we go along, please feel free to enter your questions into that Q&A box. If they refer back to a slide, just put the slide number in there so we know which one to check back to. Thank you. Go ahead, Jim. We'll continue.
Next slide. I think the first one is actually the Grants New Mexico. And again, this was a wonderful project. I guess I consider this to be the poster child of if EPA can be flexible and adaptive, anybody can. Cy Apogee is the RPM in Region 6, and he actually gave a very nice presentation at a NGWA symposium that was held right across the street from our offices here in Crystal City. So it's the Grants New Mexico, it's a dry cleaner. Next slide, and I've talked about it a bit already. This is a bit more information that hopefully will be helpful to the person who asked the question. I wouldn't dwell on this slide. It's actually what was selected in the record of decision. It isn't actually what they eventually ended up doing. But in the two red boxes to the upper left is where they did the resistive heating. And then you can see by the different colors and the different down gradient zones, they used some other technologies. They originally had selected ISCO immediately down gradient of the source, but as I said earlier, after the pilot, they decided that the reductive dechlorination would be sufficient. Even though it doesn't show up on this slide here, they had a number, 6 or 8 or whatever, transects that they installed both for the shallow and dilute portions of the plume that go down gradient and have been implementing the remedy ever since. It also turned out that there was a utility corridor up in the area that they were doing the resistive heating, and that talked about it required considerable flexibility because they had to control the temperature that was allowable in that utility zone. So they had to adapt. Even in the zone they were doing ERH, they couldn't just pour the coal to it and heat it to maximum temperature. And so they had to be very sophisticated even in that volume. Got a couple of pictures that give you a little idea what the ERH project was about. Next slide. They actually did it inside the operating dry cleaner. That's the left-hand picture as they're installing the electrodes. The picture in the upper middle, they put in a false flooring so the operators of the dry cleaner could continue to operate. They also installed the electrodes on an angled boring where necessary. They weren't able to get everywhere they needed, so that's the upper right. And then the lower right and middle, was the installation of the electrodes out in the parking lot because everything was put in subgrade, so there was no interference with either vehicular or pedestrian traffic. Next slide. So I think it's more slides of the installation going in outside the building so they could operate without interfering with the commercial operations. Next slide. A couple of slides I think that'll summarize what happened there. And again, they were optimizing the effort, starting with the preliminary design and even through the operation. So they shifted something like 30% of the monitoring wells to a shorter period or longer duration sampling. And again, as I said earlier, oftentimes if you're paying attention, your subsequent, whether it's ISCO or reductive dechlorination, your subsequent injections can be reduced in both volume and quantity. And so they used 60% less by the fourth injection, and they cut the number of injection wells almost by half. And as we indicated in the last bullet, the project seems to be ahead of schedule in terms of where they thought they'd be today. Next slide. The next project we'll talk about is a combination of two different ISCO technologies and some removal. It's a very high visibility site that was the future home of the Orlando Magic. Next slide. And again, this was, we don't do this very often at NPL sites, but most of the vendors today have both thermal and other technologies have gotten to the point now, if you want it, you can get guaranteed fixed price. You'll pay a modest premium for that. This particular project, 50% of their profit was at risk if they didn't achieve the MCLs, and they had to achieve and maintain them for 6 months. And the bottom line is that they, in fact, met their remedial action objectives. Next slide. Picture that, and again, it's a phased remediation. Next slide. First, they use catalyzed peroxide. Those of you that are familiar with ISCO understand that, generally speaking, that's about the cheapest of the ISCO remedies, so they were using that as the biggest hammer to try to knock down the source in the first place. Next slide. And then they followed it up with a permanganate to polish it off, and also because they were trying to prevent the potential for a rebound, the permanganate is more persistent than the catalyzed peroxide is. Next slide. And then again, even though, generally speaking, in the remedial world, we dig up what we need to first and then polish it off, in this particular case, they ended up finding what they thought was the source at the end. And because they were half of their profit was on the table, they continued to pay attention to what was going on in the subsurface. Next slide. And again, that's the floor drain pipe. And again, those of you that do dry cleaners and that sort of thing, as often as not, it's leaks in those sewer pipes and drains that are the ultimate source of the contamination. Next slide. One more project. It's a non-NPL solvent site. I like it because they used a host of technologies, both in terms of the active ingredients and the way they got it into the ground. Next slide. They dug up what they needed to first, next slide, then followed it up with potassium and sodium permanganate. And those of you that are familiar with permanganate, the sodium permanganate is quite a bit more soluble than the potassium permanganate, so it has different attributes and characteristics that help in different ways with the duration of the remedy. Next slide. And then again, this is a site where they did, in fact, follow up with a PRB. In this case, because it was a water channel down gradient, and they didn't want the potential for that volume to be subjected to purple color, so they put in a ZVI at the end. Next slide. Go ahead. So, they did ISCO in the source zone and hotspots. Next slide. ISCO and bio down gradient. Next slide. And here's what it looks like. This intentionally, the idea here is that this is going to fly in. But anyway, the upper left is where they did the excavation, and then they also added some permanganate. And then in the lower right is where they, in fact, did the ZVI at the toe of the plume. Next slide. And again, this is clever in terms of how they put it in. They put in these large diameter caissons. Next slide. Keep going. And then introduced the ESCO reagents into those boreholes and then flooded it to achieve the kind of near subsurface distribution they wanted. Next slide. And then they used hydraulic fracturing, which is becoming fairly prevalent for low permeability strata, to deliver both the oxidants and the reductants, as well as the ZBI slurry and the carbon substrate for the biopolishing. Next slide. So there are a couple of remaining challenges, one is which that we don't really have the tools that we need to predict resource restoration timeframes. So we have some models, screening models, that really are not satisfactory in my view to make decisions. And we don't have the tools to even quality assure those calculations. Next slide. Also, we could use some decision rules to better help us delineate the boundaries and when to change over from one technology to another. Next slide. Next slide. And again, as I think I mentioned earlier, but if I hadn't, as often as not, the transition points now for many remedies is asymptotic results or diminishing returns. When the curves start leveling off, then's the time to start thinking about, okay, what are we going to do next to continue the progress towards site closure? Next slide. So what are we trying to get? We're trying to get to the point of using the robust source terms enough, but only enough. Next slide. Transitioning in some timely way or spatially to some form of cost-effective polishing step, singular or plural. Next slide. Be nice if we could reduce or eliminate our need for pump and treat, although there's some now interest in using directed groundwater recirculation to use pump and treat systems to maximize contaminant mass recovery as opposed to just trying to contain a plume. And I don't think we'll have time to talk about that today, but I certainly encourage anyone who hasn't heard about DGR, also sometimes referred to as chaotic advection, to look into that particular option, both for making pump and treat work more effectively and can also be used in employing, whether it be ISCO or bio. Next slide. And then again, as I indicated in one of my earlier slides, we think M&A is great, but we think it's most appropriate after you've knocked down the source and the mass flux and the mass discharge in some reasonably useful way. I think we're just about done. Next slide. And there's my contact information. And I think we've got time for some more questions.
Again, if you have questions, please type them into the Q&A box down in the lower right corner of your screen. I do have a question for you, Jim. Do you know a combined remedies reference for nitroaromatics, explosives? Are you familiar with any of those?
We can find some.
Okay. We can find some, and to the person who asked that question, we will get back to you.
Yeah, I got to say, the time that we had, we really could only focus on the chlorinated solvent case today. And I do know enough about, I know a number, we've got a couple of projects going on with DOD that are dealing with those sorts of contaminants. So we should be able to find at least a reference or two or a contact for you on that.
Okay, we have just a couple of minutes still here. Jim, would you like to continue into your...
Yeah, there's a couple of tools that we've been tracking somewhat closely, and I thought if we had the time, I would go over those very, very briefly, only to sensitize you to the fact that they're out there. And I think they also contribute to this whole idea of being flexible and adaptive and combining tools. Next slide. First of which is activated carbon. There's three or four companies out there now that instead of pumping lots of water out of the ground very inefficiently, thermodynamically, to in fact put carbon in the ground, either in a colloidal form or in another form that can be fractured in. And, of course, the idea there isn't just to trap the contaminants, but also to treat them. As I say, there's three or four companies out there offering this particular approach. Some of them combine the carbon with bio, others have added iron impregnation into their carbon to have abiotic degradation of the chlorinated solvents. Next slide. Also, again, there's been over 1,000 of these ASTA applications, and there's even a couple of projects that have been done either at NPL sites or in fractured rock. Next slide. And then horizontal wells, some of you may have some experience with them, but they are, again, they've gotten better in placing them exactly where they want. You can get a lot more screened interval with a horizontal well than you can get with vertical wells. And under buildings where accessibility may be an issue, they're certainly a suitable technology. And you can either use them to inject reagents or to extract contaminants. And I think I've got an example of the former, or the latter. Next slide. Here was a horizontal well application at a gas station. The green and the dashed lines are the screened intervals, and they're chasing a plume down gradient to the left. The green lines or dashes or whatever are the air sparging wells with the vapor extraction horizontal well in the middle. Next slide. And again, you can use the horizontal wells to emplace electrodes. And this is an actual case study example that we've discussed in other presentations. So it's very suitable for that. Next slide. And I think the last thing we were going to mention, I've already mentioned it, but it's the whole idea of dynamic groundwater recirculation, where you vary your injection and extraction patterns to try to increase the distribution of reagents and improve contact between those reagents. A couple of very nice papers came out recently suggesting that if that dynamism of the subsurface, as opposed to just a more modest flow of a reagent across a zone of contamination, but if you can increase that agitation, you can significantly increase the performance of your remedial technology. Next slide. And again, even if you're just doing conventional pump and treat, you can certainly increase the rate at which you're extracting the mass. Next slide. And improve the reagent delivery and contact. So again, I'm very hopeful about that in terms of almost not quite a breakthrough, but certainly I think where appropriate, significantly improve the performance of some of our older pump and treat systems and hopefully move those sites toward site closure. Next slide. And last but not least, we've been tracking, and DOD has a number of projects trying to use DC current to improve distribution of either an oxidant or even biological reagents and even the bugs themselves, that by using electroosmosis and other phenomena that you can, in fact, improve the distribution and performance of remedial technologies in low permeability strata. And I think that's the 45 minutes. I think we're done.
Thank you, Jim. I have one last question to squeeze in for you. Are you aware of a guidance document with a decision tree or matrix for applying combined revenues to your site?
No. I've an interesting question. And with our remarks today, our idea was to suggest that it's possible to think about it in those terms. But I could go both ways of that. Maybe we'll take it under advisement. Maybe it's something that we can bring to fruition. But in some ways, the other part of my reaction is I didn't want to constrain people from thinking creatively and flexible about it. As I say, and I use that bioaugmentation pendulum specifically. So even if something historically has not been thought to be possible or feasible, and similarly when I was talking about at one time nobody wanted to combine ISCO with ISCA. On the one hand, some guidance like that might be helpful, but I would hope that if we could do it, people wouldn't feel, okay, that's all we can do, that we can try to be more flexible in the alternatives that we evaluate.
That's all the questions that we have time for today. I'll hand it back over to Michelle Mahoney to wrap us up and let you know where you should go next.
Okay, great. Thank you, Cindy and Jim, for a very informative presentation. I think I saw at one point we had well over 150 people participating in today's webinar, so good turnout. Thank you to the audience for your participation and your engaging questions. I want to invite all of you to stay connected with CLUIN using social and professional networking sites that you see on this slide here. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. You can also sign up for our free monthly newsletter called Tech Direct, and you'll learn about all of our new webinars and resources related to hazardous waste site cleanup. Again, thank you for joining today's live webinar. I'd like to remind everyone that the slides and other items related to today's session can be found on the seminar resources page. This information stays with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. You'll also find information for our speakers and organizers on the presenters page, as noted earlier, like their contact information. I'd like to ask for you to take a brief moment to fill back our online feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's session. We don't issue CEUs or PDHs for our webinars. You can save, print, and print a webinar participation certificate after submitting feedback for today's event. Be sure to check the box at the bottom of the feedback form to certify you were here for the entire event or you have replayed the complete archive. If you don't check that box, you will not get a certificate. You may find that a copy of your registration email, the seminar slides, and the feedback confirmation email are enough to document your participation in today's event with your own accrediting institution. If you participated as a group, each person can fill out an online feedback form to get their own certificate. This applies to those watching the recorded version of today's session as well. We do look at your comments, and we are always continuing to improve the content and delivery of our webinars. You can request confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. And if you require any further assistance, you can contact our Clue-In webinar guru, Gene Balance. Lastly, today's session was recorded. In the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today as part of the archive, and it takes approximately 2 weeks. You will automatically receive an email once the archive is available. That's the end of our final reminders. Thank you for joining today's session. I hope that you found it to be a valuable expenditure of your time and that we will see you on a future webinar. This is the formal